Thank you very much, and I too very much appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this group. It really is a very distinguished group of scientists, and I do want to acknowledge my my co-authors on this paper or this presentation: Felipe Torres Acosta from Mexico, Harley Nelman, and Jim Muir from the USA, Hervé Oste from France, and Irene Mueller-Harvey from Great Britain. There are more economic losses due to parasitism than any other cause throughout the world, and this is particularly true in small ruminants, and a lot of this talk is going to be focused on small ruminants because that's where most of the research has been done. Now, the gastrointestinal parasites that are probably the most pathogenic are the protozoan parasites, including coccidia, and the helminth parasites, and of these, nematodes are the most pathogenic. There's three major genera of gastrointestinal nematodes, and two in the abomasum and one in the small intestine. And of these three, far and away throughout the world, the most pathogenic is Humuncus contortus, also known as the barber pole worm or the wire worm or the blood worm, depending where you are in the world. It occurs all over the world, tropics and subtropic regions. It is has a unique feature. This little lancet that allows it to pierce the wall of the abomasum and cause the animal to bleed. And basically, the animal eventually bleeds to death when they get enough of these worms in there. And so it's, whereas most of the other parasites have more of a digestive challenge, you know, reducing absorption of nutrients and so forth, it's this anemia that makes this particular parasite so highly pathogenic. It's the most important parasite in sheep and goats in warm, wet environments, which includes the southern USA, most of the tropics and subtropics in the world. And what's interesting is that this parasite's been moving northward. And so now, in the summertime, it's a big problem in the northern US and Canada. Even in Europe, they've got it in places where it never used to occur, like in Finland and places like that. This is the life cycle, and I was going to talk about this because this is how these tannins affect different parts of the life cycle. The adults reproduce sexually in whichever organ, the small intestine or the large intestine. In the case of Humuncus, one female can lay up to 10,000 eggs per day. The eggs then pass out of the feces onto the pasture in the feces. They go through several, the eggs hatch into larvae, you know, under appropriate environmental conditions. And then the larvae begin to go through several molts. And when they reach the L3 stage, they develop a protective sheath that basically allows them to be very robust in the environment, and they're very active at that point. And they break out of the fecal pellet, and they go up and down the grass with the dew. The animal consumes it. The larvae then migrate to they actually lose their sheath in the rumen. They migrate to whatever organ they're going to be completing their life cycle in. Go into in the case of Humuncus, invades the lumen of the abomasum, goes through another molt, and then emerges as a blood-feeding adult. And this whole process takes about 3 to 4 weeks, and so, you know, it's a very rapid process. Historically, probably for the last 50 or 60 years, the main way that farmers have used to control parasites is commercial anthelmintic drugs. And these were very highly effective when they first came out, and farmers became over-dependent upon them and used them too much or misused them, which has led to multiple anthelmintic resistance, which is resistance to several different drugs at the same time. And it's a major problem throughout the world. These drugs are also expensive, or they can be, and now there's public concerns over drug residues in meat and milk products. And there's environmental concerns over excreted anthelmintics. And so there's a lot of incentive to find alternative ways to control parasites. Some of the control measures that have really begun to take off, one one is strategic deworming using either the Famasha system or the five-point check. The Famasha system, both of these were actually developed in South Africa. The Famasha system is based on anemia level. When you look at the eye of the animal, you know, if it's red or pink, then they're healthy. If it's white, then they need to be dewormed. It's based on what we call the 80-20 rule, that 80% of the parasites live in about 20% of the animals in any herd or flock. And so if you can identify that 20%, you can save a lot on your drug bill and also get rid of most of your problems. This five-point check was developed for non-anemic parasites, you know, ones that cause the animal to lose weight. So there's been a lot of research on alternative methods of gastrointestinal rheumatoid control. Some of the ones that have shown promise, one is copper oxide wire particles, which is just a little, look like little copper filings. And these are used in, it actually kills adult humuncus, almost like a drug. Larvae trapping or nematode trapping fungi kill the developing, as the egg is excreted on the pasture and the larvae begin to develop, the fungus develops these little loops and actually consumes the larvae and prevents the animal from being reinfected. There's also been attempts to develop vaccines against humuncus, which is also to control the adult. And then what I'm going to talk about today, feeding antiparasitic plants, which affects all three phases of the life cycle, the eggs, the larvae, and the adults. This is not a new concept, however. Plant parts, plants, and extracts have been used for millennia to treat internal parasitism in animals. A lot, even now, there's just a large number of plants that have come from traditional ethno-veterinary sources throughout the world. And most of this activity is due to bioactive compounds or secondary metabolites, plant secondary metabolites, and all of these have been reported to have antiparasitic effects. Today's talk is going to be mainly on condensed tannins. And I'll go through this quickly because we've already talked about it. There's two main types of tannins, condensed and hydrolyzable, and most of our work on the antiparasitic effects are with the condensed type. This is kind of just a reminder from Dr. Mueller-Harvey's talk that these tannins vary in concentration and also in composition, such as the prodolphinidin to procyanidin ratio and the size. Like in birds with tree fall, relatively low. Lespedeza is relatively high. Large molecules, relatively small molecules. It also, the concentration, as Dr. Mueller-Harvey said, varies with cultivar, with the plant part, usually more in leaves than stems, with plant maturity, you know, as the season goes on, as she showed, and also with processing methods, either sun curing, grinding and pelleting, or ensiling. But the anthelmintic effects of condensed tannins are associated with their ability to form complexes with both plant and parasite proteins. And as she said, as the first speaker said, the sticky feet of the tannins allows it to coat the proteins on the parasite. So the mechanism of action has been explained by two hypotheses, either indirect or direct effects. The indirect effect is more of a nutritional theory based on, you know, with higher amount of rumen escape protein, there's more essential amino acids reaching the small intestine with tannin-containing legumes, or at least certain types of tannin-containing legumes. And the theory is that will allow the animal to mount an immune response and actually expel some of the parasites. But most of the evidence actually is for direct effects of condensed tannins on nematodes. There's been a lot of in vitro studies that shown extracts from a wide range of tannin-rich forages or browse plants either delay or inhibits excretion of the infective larvae, and so the larvae don't successfully infect the host. This is more evidence of direct effects of condensed tannins. These are on adult worms that were recovered from animals fed tannin-containing legumes, sanfoin, salum, and sericea. This is the control. These are electron micrographs, scanning electron microscopy. You can see there's evidence anyway that the appearance of these deep cuticular ridges and just, you know, I'm not sure exactly, we're still not sure exactly how it's doing it, but that's not a happy worm. Some of the concepts that I wanted to introduce were concept of nutraceuticals. This was mentioned previously. It's a livestock feed which combines nutritional value with beneficial effects on animal health. And that's what most of this talk is going to be about, plants that are first to feed, but also have plant secondary metabolites that have some antiparasitic effects. You also have psychotherapeutic effects where the plant secondary metabolites are actually extracted from the plant and then given to the animal as an herbal remedy. So the differences between these, the psychotherapeutics are short-term, like you say, almost given like a medicine, but the anthelmintic effects are based on these secondary plant metabolites. And it's the same with nutraceuticals, except these are long-term, and they're based on voluntary feed intake. So it's actually a feed first. And if the animal doesn't eat it, you know, it really doesn't matter how effective it is against parasites. If the animals don't eat it, then it's not going to be effective. For either one of these, we need to validate the anthelmintic properties when we begin to search for these plants that have anthelmintic antiparasitic effects. And we've used in vitro assays, in vivo feeding or grazing trials, and then the final thing is a practical application in farming systems. And that's really the ultimate goal. Some of the advantages of the in vitro anthelmintic assays, it allows us to target specific phases of the GIN life cycle, such as the eggs, the larvae. This was one that Irene's work was talking about, larval achievement inhibition assay, but also adults, looking at the adult motility. As I say, the advantages of these in vitro assays, you can screen a large number of plants rapidly. The specificity, you can look at different stages of the gastrointestinal nematode life stage and also individual compounds, you know, tannins and other plant secondary metabolites. Some of the disadvantages, you can't create the actual physiological conditions in the host animal, and there are some confounding interactions between the anthelmintic compounds in the plant and the host compounds, and it's difficult to separate those. A large number of plant extracts have been screened of temperate legumes, also tropical and subtropical legumes, shrub species, and tree legumes. You know, there's probably, you know, just dozens and dozens of these papers where they've looked at different types of plants. And what we found through the in vitro screening is that tannins can affect the biology of the nematode by reducing egg hatching, reducing larval development. It can interfere with the excrement, can interfere with motility of adult worms. We've discovered that these responses are dose dependent, that there's different effects with different tannin structures and other plant secondary metabolites, that they have different effects in different nematode species, species, and other parasites such as Imeria, which is coccidia, and ascarids, which is a problem in pigs. Also, we can look at worms from different animal species, such as small ruminants, cattle, camelids, so forth. So it gives us a lot of flexibility. And this is some work, some slides that Irene provided for the talk from some work that they were doing in Europe. This was some of the factors that affect anthelmintic activity. And this is in C. elegans, which is an adult soil nematode. It's used as a model for adult infective nematodes. Basically, as the percentage of prodelphinidins increased, the activity, the more prodelphinidin there was, the greater the activity against motility in adults. This is another one on larvae, using the in vitro larval excreta inhibition assay. What they found was that tannin features had significant effects. The greater the amount of prodelphinidin, the more anthelmintic effect. Also, larger tannin size had a greater anthelmintic effect. And this was true in Hemuncus, but with Trichostrongylus, which is a small intestinal parasite, only the effect that showed differences for was increasing prodelphinidin concentration. And so the tannins appear to have different modes of action against different abomasal or intestinal parasites. So it depends on the parasite and the tannin. This is looking at cattle parasites. This was sanfoin. Sanfoin reduced the number of ostratagi worms in calves, but had no effect on Cuperia. And ostratagi is a abomasal worm, whereas Cuperia is a small intestinal worm. And this is some of the work that she mentioned about the potential synergistic effects. This is tannins alone. This is the predictive additive effect when they added flavonoids. And what they found was there was actually a synergistic effect, a much higher reduction in, not sure exactly what this was. Excretement, that's right, yeah. Okay. L3 excretement. And so this is very exciting work that really does open up a whole new area of complex but interesting work of potential synergistic effects between different compounds. The next step, then, once you've found something that has an in vitro effect is to confirm it in vivo. And unfortunately, there's not been a lot of in vivo studies. It's only been completed for a limited number of tannin-rich legumes, and these are some of them. A lot of this work was originally kind of started in New Zealand about 25 years ago with birds for trefoil, big trefoil, sella, and sanfoin. It's since been followed up with quite a bit of work in Europe and now North America. There's been fewer species of worm season legumes that have really been, that they've done confirmation with in vivo studies. But one of those is Serratia lespediza, and that's a lot of what I'm going to be talking about, because that's the work that we've been doing in our lab mostly. And also some work with Harley Nauman and Jim Muir with panicle tick clover. Also some work with tropical browse type plants in Mexico and Africa. And there's quite a bit of interest now in agro-industrial byproducts. And one of the reasons that we're interested in these is because it's a much more stable type of tannin. And so there's been some work again in Mexico and Europe and North America and different places with these different byproducts. These are some of the in vivo results that we've had so far. You can get up to 90% reduction in egg counts, up to 70% reduction in larval establishment, and up to 80% reduction in actual adult worms. But you can see from each of these that the differences are quite variable. And so that's one of the real challenges that Dr. Mueller-Harvey was talking about, is how can we get to a more stable result long term. So in looking for nutraceutical plants based on warm season vegetative or browse legumes, some of the advantage of these, they often have a high concentration of the prodelphinidin type tannins. There's also a great diversity of species, vegetative legumes, native and introduced vegetative legumes, tree legumes, and agro-industrial byproducts. There's also quite a bit of flexibility in feeding systems, grazing or direct browsing, cut and carry systems, and then dried and preserved forages. Some of the disadvantages of these warm season tannin containing legumes is potential anti-nutritional effects, limitations on feeding systems with resource poor farmers. They just don't have the flexibility that other farmers do. Often limited information on agronomic attributes and particularly propagation methods. And this is a real challenge, is the complexity of the nutrition, tannin, and host-parasite interactions under natural grazing or browsing conditions. And that's, we're attempting to unravel some of that, but it takes, that's just going to be an ongoing challenge. So as we're looking for candidate nutraceuticals of these warm season species, we need to consider agronomic considerations, their suitability for cultivation. This is a big one. Availability of seeds. It may work great, but if farmers can't get seeds, then it's going to be a real challenge. How easy it is to establish, and its adaptability to different soils and climates. Its flexibility for use in different feeding systems, grazing, browsing, making into hay or perhaps pellets or silage. And really the big challenge with each of those is how each of these different things affects anthelmintic properties. Some of the nutritional considerations, the macronutrient and micronutrient profile, volatile feed intake by the host species. Say, if they don't eat it or don't eat enough of it, then you won't get the anthelmintic effect. Digestibility needs to be at least reasonable, and no toxic effects. We also need to consider some of the other benefits, that most of these forages, or these tannin-containing forages, don't cause bloat. Some have activity against pathogenic bacteria, such as E. coli. They're environmentally friendly. This was mentioned earlier. Reduced ruminal methane. And they have bioactivity against other parasites, such as ascarids. Some in the literature showed even activity against cattle ticks. Okay. So this is the primary thing. High, consistent level of bioactivity against internal parasites. Unfortunately, there's been very little work done at this level, and that really the only ones that have had this kind of work done was Sanfoin in Europe that Dr. Mueller-Harvey was talking about, and Serresia lespidiza in USA and Africa. And so I'll just kind of go through this quickly. Lespidiza is a warm season legume, high in tannins. It's tolerant of low pH. It grows on infertile soils. This is where it's adapted in the U.S. and throughout the world. Some of the agronomic advantages, grows on a wide range of soil types, needs no nitrogen fertilization, deep rooting, so it's a low input forage, needs not a whole lot of phosphorus fertilization, drought tolerant, little insect damage, and it sheds its lower leaves, which improves soil fertility and reduces soil erosion. These are some of the different forms: fresh forage, grazing, hay, leaf meal, pellets, and silage. And so I'm actually doing a silage study right now. And so, traditionally, it was considered a moderate quality forage. This is a cattle study. Intake was similar to Bermuda grass, gains were similar to Bermuda grass. It's actually a little bit better in the short term compared to Bermuda grass for goats. Long term, there can be some drop off, and so we're still trying to figure out why that happens as you feed it longer term. Other benefits: no bloat, as I said, reduced methane production, antibacterial, kills house flies. It also reduces somatic cell count in goat milk. This was the some work that we did with Irene's lab. It's very quite high concentration of tannins in the leaves, not as much in the stems. Pellets maintain the high concentration because this was leaf meal pellets. The structure, it's very high prodelphinidin. As I said, it's almost 100%, and very large molecules. And so, this is, I'll just quickly go through some of this. Grazing trials, we'll drop to this one here, 95% and 71% reduction in egg counts in kids grazing Lespediza or Lespediza plus Bermuda grass pasture compared with Bermuda grass pasture only. This is hay results. As soon as we started feeding, there was about an 80% drop in egg count, and it stayed low. This is hay results as well. About a 70-75% actual kill of adult humuncus. Lower in of Ostertagia and Trichostrongylus, but still significant. This is effective pelleting. And each time we would do this, more tannin would be bound to protein. So we really didn't expect these results, but we kept getting this, you know, and Dr. Mueller-Harvey talked about this a bit too, that we continued to get, like in this case, the pelleted Lespediza actually did better than the unpelleted. This is effects of silage. Slightly less effective than hay, but still effective. I guess I probably need to wrap it up.
Well, you're only between us and the coffee break.
Okay. Well, let me just jump ahead then. This is most effective against humuncus. These are some results against Imeria, and it was very effective against Imeria. And so it's really got a lot of potential as a anti-coccidial forage. And that was the silage. Pardon? This one here was with silage. This was with pellets. And this is just showing some of the direct effects, you know, on the cuticle. And I did want to just mention this, because really the key is what happens on farm. And this is an on-farm study with Lespediza in with cattle and sheep producers in South Africa. And this was the farmer that we worked with, he lives in the KwaZulu-Natal region in a little town called Matatiele, about 5,000 feet up in the mountains. Oops. He had sheep and cattle, grazed Lespediza during the summer, fed round bales to beef cattle in the winter, and used it as his base roughage for a total mixed ration for his dairy cows. He said he planted it on his worst soils, and over several years it improved the soil structure and earthworm activity, and had higher quality of associated grasses, which is interesting. And it tremendously increased his carrying capacity over the native grasses that he was using, like four or five times higher, without health problems. He did several studies where he showed he had similar weight gains in beef cattle and milk production in dairy cows compared with fertilized grass, which is what he normally would use, at a lot lower cost. And these are just some of the results of SL grazing, SL plus native grass and native grass, and it had similar results to what we've seen. The weights were the same. The dosing of sheep was much lower in the Lespediza. And this is just a couple of his comments. I also did want to mention that it's got potential for commercialization. There's actually a company in Alabama that's currently marketing Lespediza leaf meal pellets. And I think it's going to be useful for developing farmers, but I'll go on with that. These are some of the future research. I think we already covered some of that. The consistency. is really a key. More in vivo studies under different epidemiological conditions in different climatic zones, different feeding systems, and with different host species and parasite species. And this self-medication concept needs to be explored more, that animals actually, if they have parasites, they'll select tannins, plants that are high in tannins to relieve their parasite problems. Future research requires a multidisciplinary approach, cooperation between veterinarians, plant animal breeders, animal nutritionists. Dr. Mueller Harvey, I think, was a tremendous example of the need for a team approach. And this is the American Consortium for Small Ruminant Parasite Control that I've been very fortunate to be a part of, that's using a similar approach. And this is the potential, I think, moving forward for incorporating these things into livestock production systems for as a nutraceutical against parasites.
Thank you very much.